Tom Woods Show, episode 1858.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Folks, police abuse is being talked about all over the country, but what is sadly missing is a libertarian perspective. And you can get that in my brand new free ebook, The Problems with the Police and How to Fix Them, A Libertarian Perspective. Pick it up at problemswithpolice.com. Hey folks, Tom Woods here. Gary Chartier week continues, and today we're going to talk about Christianity and the state. And this is another topic that comes up quite a bit in our circles among libertarians and even among conservatives and others. How should Christians view the state, and are they obligated to take a naive view of the state? Well, we're going to hash that out a bit today, Gary Chartier and I. You may know by now who Gary Chartier is. Of course, I've given you his bio a couple of times, but I want to remind you that Gary is a polymath who has made contributions to philosophy, theology, business ethics, and legal theory. And that means that we can have a nice Gary Chartier week and cover all sorts of different topics. So, Gary, welcome back.
Great to be here, Tom.
All right. Well, now we're going to talk about Christianity and the state. A lot of things to be said here, but I guess the key thing is that comes up are particular verses that, you know, have been interpreted a particular way. And obviously Romans 13, you just cannot get away from. So I do want to talk about that. My concern is that I think sometimes, and I guess maybe this is a concern more that I have than other people have, sometimes libertarians are so anxious to make the Bible into a libertarian text that they'll take certain verses and they'll interpret them in ways that are certainly plausible on their face, but that are ways that nobody interpreted them ever, or until maybe you got, you know, David Lipscomb in the 19th century or something. Yeah. But almost nobody interpreted them that way. So it just doesn't, I don't think that seems plausible to a non-Christian that all of a sudden in 2021 you figured out that actually, even though this looks like a verse about supporting the state, it's the exact opposite. It just seems like special pleading to me. So how do you deal with, let's say, some of the harder verses that seem to indicate that the state is an important part of a flourishing society?
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right that no intellectual engagement with the Christian tradition that ignores what really seems to be going on in individual biblical passages or in later, you know, Christian texts is responsible, right? I mean, I think you can't begin with the assumption that what you find in a text is just a convenient confirmation of what you already thought. You have to, I think, try to grapple with what's going on. So Romans 13, I think you're right, is obviously the locus classicus of these discussions, with St. Paul's injunction to be subject to the authorities. And it seems as if, right, I mean, there's a lot going on, and of course that passage has received a great deal of attention from people who aren't in any way libertarians, particularly, you know, perhaps unsurprisingly, given that it was, I think, used, say, in the 30s to tell Germans that they really ought to be obedient to the Nazi regime. So naturally, in the wake of World War II and that kind of language, people revisited it pretty carefully, because there was, you know, certainly the desire not to be focused on things that way, not to interpret it that way. Yeah, Romans 13 is often, I think, kind of interestingly juxtaposed with Revelation 13, where the Roman Empire is viewed as a ravenous beast. And by contrast, in Romans 13, St. Paul, who is, of course, a Roman citizen, you know, while he's sometimes encountered the bad side of the empire, really has had, in general, a pretty positive relationship with it, wants to focus on it that way. So it seems as if what he's fundamentally saying, you know, perhaps the reading that's most kind of favorable to the sort of approach that you and I might want to take is maybe one that says, look, what he's fundamentally concerned about is the importance of maintaining social order and of seeing justice done. And in the immediate moment in which he's writing, it certainly looks as if the Roman Empire is the entity that's available to do that. right? He's not contemplating, it seems to me. He's not reacting to, and probably isn't even considering, the possibility that there might be, first of all, a more liberal state or even no state at all providing those kinds of things. You know, it seems to me he doesn't want, obviously, to encourage the congregants to whom he's writing to either for their own sake or for the sake of other Christians to get into conflict with the state, to become, like many of his fellow Jews at the time, kind of active and potentially violent opponents of the state. And at the same time, I think he really does believe we need social order, we need a system of justice, and the empire is providing that. So let's accept that and, you know, take advantage of it. Now, he clearly doesn't think that the empire is behaving uniformly well. We note, for instance, in I think it's in the Corinthian correspondence, where he really wants the early Christians to resolve disputes within congregations, and really thinks it's shameful if they resort to the empire's courts. So he's not unaware, I think, of some problems with the legal system and so forth at the time. But at the same time, it seems to me, I take it probably a fairly pragmatic view that encourages people to recognize what he thinks at the moment is the positive role that the empire is playing. You know, it's kind of ironic because I take it he ends up, of course, being executed by the empire. And we think about the picture of the empire again that's experienced by elsewhere in the ancient Mediterranean, like, the recipients of the letters to the churches in Revelation, they're clearly experiencing the empire in a very different way. But at least for the moment, at the heart of the empire, where Paul's writing, after all, from Rome itself later, and here to Christians in Rome, and focusing there, you know, the empire seems like it's serving a useful purpose. And I think he's just kind of prepared to accept that.
I think that's as reasonable a take on it as I've ever heard, that I think some people are trying to build an entire worldview out of what I wonder if St. Paul himself might have wondered was just a passing remark.
Yes.
And they built a whole structure out of it.
Yeah.
So that's an issue. Now, I think that relevant to our evaluation of the state from a Christian standpoint are some ideas that come actually from Sam Konkin, who, when he's comparing the market and the state, he's comparing two different ways human beings interact with each other. And now these are maybe idealized versions of both of those things. But obviously, in the case of politics, that really is a zero-sum game because one side wins, the other side loses. One side gets its bill passed, the other side doesn't. And that bill, let's say, pits the farmers against industry or industry against this one, or the old against the young, or the blacks against whites, or whatever it is. It's always pitting one group against another. And that encourages rent-seeking behavior. It encourages people to think that if I want to get ahead, I got to make sure I have some lobbyists in Washington to make sure I get the special advantage. Whereas in the marketplace, we're dealing with each other in a situation in which we think of the other person as an end in him or herself.
Yes.
And not as a cow to be milked or as a resource to be exploited. And if I'm going to get your cooperation with what I want, I have to offer you something that you value. This is a realm of peace. And so I think when we look at these two things, I haven't heard it really described that way within the Christian tradition. But if it were, I think that would go a long way toward influencing how we want our society to be run and which one of these models is preferable.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And of course, Konkin's typology there reminds one of the earlier similar approach that you might find, well, even earlier, maybe in Herbert Spencer, but especially in Franz Oppenheimer's The State, right, with the distinction between the economic and the political means of gaining wealth. You know, that that characterization reflects the view that the economic means is precisely the means of peaceful voluntary cooperation. The political means, is a matter of using force. And, so Spencer uses the term, the militant type of social organization there. So I think that's exactly right, that if you value peace and you value mutual respect, then you have to be sensitive to the way in which a political order that is a political order rooted in the activity of a monopolistic state sets people loose to view each other as competitors in the bad sense as either there to be exploited or as exploiters to be resisted. And so, you know, I think there is this very sort of naive view that somehow, you know, if we really want to have a sense of community, then we have to have state politics. And, you know, isn't it just so corrosive to have market relations? And what you've rightly highlighted, I think, is that when there's a state in place, there's an institution that is inherently corrosive in a way that markets just aren't, because it tends to undermine social connection to the extent that people can, you know, seek to displace each other as those who manipulate the state apparatus and get benefits from it at each other's expense.
You received a PhD in the Faculty of Divinity at Cambridge University in, I guess, 1991.
Yeah.
And this was at a time, based on what we said in the first episode of this week, when your views had taken more of a social democratic turn. So there you were in a divinity school, in effect. I guess I'm curious about, as your political ideas changed, I would assume at that time you did not say to yourself, well, my views are social democratic, but I can see that the Christian tradition is at odds with that, and that it really is pointing toward a more laissez-faire society. I would rather suspect that you did not feel in conflict at that time. So as your ideas evolved, did your religious ideas evolve? Did your approach to religious texts evolve, to the Christian tradition evolve? If so, how?
That's a really good question, Tom. And it's a really good question that, while in some sense I've certainly thought about before, I haven't thought about in quite the way you've posed it. So I'll have to think as I talk about this. So I was certainly aware of positions that might well have been outside the mainstream at that point. But the mainstream certainly was, I think, there, as in, you know, probably most comparable programs in the English-speaking world since World War II. The environment was largely statist. People, I think just assumed that what we really need is, the government to really do its job. And I do think there was often a sort of naive view that if we could just, you know, kind of get the right people and get the malign influences out of politics, we can certainly, see things improve. By far, the most capable person in the divinity faculty at the time I was there was Nicholas Lash, who was the first Catholic to hold a divinity chair at Cambridge since the Reformation. So the fact that he'd written a book about Marx didn't mean that he was himself necessarily quite a Marxist, but I think his views certainly would have been quite lefty politically. And I think that was all just very much in the air, and it was, you know, it was also, I think, the approach that was taken by, the person who had been my primary undergraduate teacher of Christian ethics, and so it all seemed very natural, I think, to embrace that sort of viewpoint. The one thing that I did, in my dissertation, which was about the idea of friendship, that really was perhaps a bit out of the ordinary, even in that environment, was that when I talked in the final chapter about friendship and politics, a relationship that, of course, has been important since the work of Plato and Aristotle and Cicero, I did talk about radically decentralized political institutions. I wasn't thinking in kind of Marx and anarchist terms, but I was imagining at any rate the importance of radical decentralization in a way that's, you know, close to what you might get in, I think, a number of social anarchists. And so, you know, I was kind of pushing back in that way. But I think I did just take it for granted that, some broadly lefty view of economy and society was inherently Christian, and people who took other views, you know, somebody like, say, Michael Novak at the time. I think of Michael in particular because, well, I certainly never knew him well. I did encounter him there, and his youngest daughter was actually a member of my college. You know, that just seemed kind of alien to me. And it's not that I thought, oh, you know, these people are evil, but I just didn't quite get how they thought about things. So I don't think that the theological perspective that I took, you know, if you looked at kind of what I wrote in graduate school and then the first book that I completed after that, which didn't ultimately get published until 2007, which I wrote in draft form in 1992, you know, I think I took different views on economic and related matters when I talked about them, indeed, in the first edition of that 2007 book I did. But the broader theological context, I think, didn't change. I think it was really, I think the economic views just sort of developed on their own and developed with the view that, this is just the way sensible people think about these matters. It wasn't that there was some kind of careful development of those economic views from the underlying theological views. And so I think the theological views really, if you look at, say, the two editions of that book, The Analogy of Love, I don't think the theology is particularly different, even as the economics might have changed. So, I think it's probably the case just that I refined the ethical theory views that I took, but in terms of seeing how those fit together with economic understanding, I think that just involved developing better economic understanding, which seemed perfectly compatible with the underlying moral perspective that I'd adopted. Maybe I'd want to say more with more time, but I bet there are other things we should talk about.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, I just love that I asked you a question that really, really made you go back and think. So good. I'm going to give myself 1 point for that. I want to go back actually and just say one other quick thing about Romans 13, because couldn't somebody say, let's say at the time of the war in Iraq in 2003, mm-hmm. that the people who supported Saddam Hussein were also doing the right thing because they were supposed to support the powers that be there? Well, that's Saddam Hussein. So it's almost like it explains too much. It means that everybody has to support everything. Well, so then if there are two countries at war, apparently you can't blame either one of them.
Yeah, so I wonder how somebody who took a more conventionally statist view of that passage would respond. I mean, I can imagine a neocon saying something like this there, right? Well, but if you look at the underlying purpose that St. Paul envisions in Romans 13, Saddam wasn't fulfilling that purpose. And so therefore,
I see. Okay.
I would guess that that's probably how that person would respond, that we're in fact bearing the sword for the whole world. I mean, which is obviously a deeply troubling notion, but I think that would have been the idea that, Saddam isn't another equally valid bearer of the sword. Saddam is precisely one of those baddies the bearers of the sword have to punish, and his own subjects surely recognize that.
Okay, all right. That's a reasonable answer, and I would want to try to anticipate what their objection to that would be. Okay, that's fair enough. So another thing I want to talk about is the idea that it could be possible that you would resist the state, even up to the point of overthrowing a regime or even murdering the person, let's say regicide. And when we look at, again, not the text, but the tradition, we look at what commentators and fathers and theologians said in the first several hundred years, even well beyond the first several hundred years, we do not find there a robust tradition of saying the bad ruler can be actively deposed and maybe even disposed of. We do get some of that, and maybe I'm missing somebody along the line, but when we get to some of the Spanish scholastics in the 16th century, like Juan de Mariana, mm-hmm. who was outspoken about this, you do start to get that. But that's a long, long time. And today, I find Christian libertarians, who more or less do believe that, of course, we can stand up to the regime and do this. But it seems to me just very interesting that it took a long, long time. I mean, there were Christians who, I think to some degree, people have exaggerated the wickedness of the Roman Empire toward Christians, because it was quite sporadic. Mm-hmm. When it was bad, it was very bad. But generally, it wasn't an unrelenting hunting down of Christians, certainly. I mean, certainly, we have Pliny's letter to Trajan and so forth about that. Yeah. But my point is, does this tell us something? That even at the time of the Roman Empire, they were not saying we should overthrow the emperor. They were basically saying, I don't know, maybe this is a punishment for our sins or something. So what does that mean for us today?
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right as I understand the history. And look, you're a professional historian and I'm not, so I undoubtedly there are things you would be aware of that I wouldn't be. But I don't think that there's a whole lot there, certainly in the patristic period, in either East or West, that suggests anything like armed resistance or justified revolution. You might get some hints a little earlier than the 16th century. There might be some hints of, some kinds of resistance that might be at least tepidly approved during the late medieval period, you might think with Aquinas or with some of the Franciscans. But I think, it doesn't really happen until the 16th century. And it's probably not coincidental, right, that Catholics and Protestants both start talking about this stuff at the point when there really has been a kind of breakdown in the religious consensus in Europe, and you have Catholics subjected to Protestant rulers and vice versa. And so it's perhaps not unsurprising that you then find on both sides theories of justified resistance and justified revolution really come to the fore then. So obviously, once you have the conversion of Constantine, and the perception is that the empire is, for the moment, God's agency, and of course that sense is going to persist in various ways in both the East and West for a long period. It's probably not surprising that while there's obviously the possibility that you can have a genuinely demonic ruler, the general perception initially, I take it, is, look, we really are in a setting in which God's will is being done in history here. During the period before Constantine, I suppose you don't get this sort of idea, first and foremost, because there is already this oppositional dynamic, even if it doesn't always involve open violent persecution. But if you want to avoid open violent persecution, one thing you certainly want to do is to not begin to encourage people to revolt. So probably, again, there's a really pragmatic reason there. You may well be right that also there would have been the thought that, well, we deserve this in one way or another. Though that can't have been the only thing, right? Because again, I want to come back to Revelation 13 and this depiction there of what the empire, I guess, looks like to Christians in Asia Minor, toward the latter part of the first century, where the empire is a ravenous beast. And so I don't think there the perception is we're just getting what we deserve. The depiction of the empire there is as an agency of Satan. So I don't think it's just going to be, well, we're going to just accept this as our lot. I think there is going to be the recognition that sometimes it is genuinely evil, but there's also the perception that probably not much we can do about it, and we're going to make it worse if we push back.
And I guess the idea, at least, that in principle, the Pope could depose an incorrigibly wicked ruler or one who was in some way undermining the church, at least plants the seeds of the idea that it's not completely out of the realm of possibility that the man who's your king today might not be your king tomorrow through human intervention. So that's something.
Right, because you have as early as the 12th century, maybe even earlier than that, but the Pope's explicitly saying, we have the ability to release you from any oath of allegiance.
Yeah.
Yeah, so there is clearly that idea in play. It doesn't seem, I suppose, very threatening as a general matter if it's really just the church and the head of the church doing that. But it does at least raise the question whether that sort of thing could in principle be justified. And obviously, once that seed is planted, it can grow and thrive.
Right. And of course, the point that they were trying to make by illustrating that, by putting out that principle, was that the spiritual order was superior to the temporal one.
Yes.
And so that's not quite the principle that we're going for in just the general question I had to you about, is there within the Christian tradition the roots of we can overthrow the regime and even punish these SOBs? I think your answer about the Christian population settled into a kind of satisfaction with the existing order because the leader certainly seemed to be promoting what was good and true and promoting the faith. Again, I think that's as good an explanation as any. We have a few minutes left, and I've been doing a lot of asking of questions. Is there a theme related to Christianity and the state that we haven't raised that you think is important?
Well, probably a lot of themes are important here because I think it's been an interesting relationship, right, that you might see any number of reasons, going back to the story of Samuel's rejection of the call to name a king, in the Old Testament, and then to what certainly seems like a very arm's length relationship on the part of Jesus with the state at his time. You might think then that there would have been a more self-consciously critical stance over time. And I guess I think it's an interesting historical question, just kind of following up on the queries that you've pushed me on, to wonder why, even as people pragmatically recognize that, you know, most of the time it's not going to make any sense to take on an entity like the Roman Empire or its various successors, why there wasn't, as it were, more acknowledgement, I guess, of the importance of critical distance between the state and people on the ground, even if there wasn't much they could do about it. Right. So you read, you know, you think about texts from the Reformation era and after, from those in the Radical Reformation tradition who tend to be pacifists. So they're certainly not urging some kind of revolt, but they also really see the state as, in one way or another, something that they ought to be viewing quite critically. And I guess it's just interesting to note and to wonder about the dynamics in play, the degree to which early on in the period of, religiously undivided Europe, but then later as well, there clearly is this sense very often that religious leaders, you know, no doubt sometimes for very good reasons, out of good motives, think that, you know, indeed, instead of looking critically at those state authorities, what they want to do, well, they want to influence them to behave well, and so they're going to cozy up to them. And clearly that's not always what happens. Sometimes you get very dramatic rebukes of kings. But it is interesting that that Radical Reformation attitude, that Anabaptist attitude, never seems to have been a very dominant one. And that's just an interesting historical question for me about how that came to be.
Yeah, agreed. I likewise find that interesting. And you mentioned pacifism. And I guess one thing I've always wondered, now our friend Bob Murphy is a pacifist.
Yes.
And he is, I debated him on pacifism and I lost. So he's good at it.
Yeah, yeah.
But he's really thought about it deeply. But I respect Bob for a lot of reasons, but I also respect his view on this because he really is consistent. He is completely against the state. And I think if you're really going to be a pacifist, it can't just be I'm against war. Because if what you're against is violence, then you can't say, well, I'm against war, but you know, we really, really need these subsidies for, you know, renewable energy or something. So we're going to have to crack some skulls for that. You know, that it seems like if you're against violence, you got to be against violence the whole way. And maybe some of the blind spot there is that we're not exactly raised to look at the state as being an engine of violence, are we? We're looking at the state as an engine of justice. So I don't think we even think of it that way.
I think that's really helpful. And, you know, so maybe I didn't say this. I put this topic on our agenda for this week in part because I'm writing a book on this topic right now. I'm writing a book called The Theology of the Nation State. And it's been interesting to grapple with thinkers who are in that kind of broad Radical Reformation tradition and notice, I think, this phenomenon that you're talking about, that even people who are very much aware of the corrupt and violent nature of the state can seem too willing to say, well, but of course, lots of things the state does, you know, really can be separated out from these acts of violence. And I want to say, well, actually, no, because that threat of violence, criminal punishment for those who don't go along, and of course, criminal punishment for those who don't provide financial support, that's always lurking in the background. So I do think that those who are full-on pacifists need to be less sanguine, probably, about state action there. You know, I'm, again, as I've said before, kind of very much on these matters in the broad Aristotelian Thomist tradition. I want really, really robust limits on everybody's use of force, and especially because it's especially dangerous on the states, right? If we're going to have a state, I think we need to argue for radical limits on what the state does. But that doesn't mean I'm a pacifist. I end up, I think, agreeing with the pacifists much of the time on practical matters, but I'm not there with them. But I think if they are going to take the position they do, then it seems to me they need to be much more critical, I think, of various sorts of state action than perhaps sometimes they might be.
Well, I'm going to link at tomwoods.com/1858 to at least one other episode where we've tried to wrestle with these kinds of questions, particularly the Romans 13 question, which I get all the time, Gary. I get it all the time. So I'm going to link to that. But this whole week, 1855678 that we've done so far, the show notes pages have really helpful links to books that we've talked about, books sometimes written by Gary. So definitely make sure and check out the show notes pages for this week. And then tomorrow's our final episode together. And this is actually the one I've been looking forward to the most because of your work on friendship. And when you pose the topic to me, you pose it as politics, ethics, and friendship, and then raising the questions, how is friendship politically significant? How do we maintain friendships across ideological divides? I think that's a particularly useful question today, because the United States, I think, is far. I think I probably got to know you. I think we met for the first time at the Nullify Now event that Michael Bolden put on back in 2011 in Los Angeles. And what a great event. I mean, I remember who else was there? Scott Horton was there. Anthony Gregory was there.
Yes.
It's a wonderful time. But I think even just since those 10 years, it's gotten to the point where people just are not interested in listening to each other at all. And with all the lockdowns, we have people saying, well, you're not taking the virus seriously, or you're ruining my kid's life because he can't play sports and he's depressed and whatever. And people have just had friendships completely implode over this. So it's going to be very interesting to talk about that.
Absolutely, Tom. I think it's super important. And I think you've teased it as much as you need to. I hope people tune in and think about how their own friendships can be affected by this.
Yeah, exactly. So that's coming up tomorrow. So make sure and tune in for that. And Gary, thanks again.
Great, Tom.
All right, everybody. Tomorrow on the program, we're going to complete Gary Chartier Week with a discussion of friendship and the meaning of friendship, and what the significance of politics is with regard to friendship, and indeed, whether politics ought to interfere with a good friendship. Well, that's pretty relevant to the world we're living in right now, I'd say. So tune in for that tomorrow. I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.